Good morning, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Band, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Appreciate you being here. It means a lot to me. I apologize for the water sounds going through the walls. I was impatient. I want to wait for whoever's showering to stop, so I'm here. I apologize for not being here the last 2 weeks. I had a lot come up and just couldn't find the time to be able to sit down and record or to even think about what I'll talk about. And that's part of daily life, especially for any other adults out there. So I know I'm not the only one, but I'm glad to be here. It makes my morning to know that I can sit here and talk to you. We've been considering a lot of concepts this week about humility and what it means to be able to put our ideas down. You know, humility is a loaded term, and I see humility as the opposite side of the coin to arrogance, where arrogance can sometimes reek of confidence, and in some ways I would say it is almost necessary to have a seat of confidence in order to push forward into the space where we want to enact change. Enacting change comes through control, and control has its place. Not everybody wants to be controlled, and some situations take a soft hand. I'm humbled by my aggression perpetually because my energy levels tend to mishandle a lot of situations, and this is in a box where the interaction is between me and me. You know, and later we'll talk about interactions with others. More complicated. You know, but a lot of the time I'm humbled by my idiocy and by my mistakes. I'm humbled when I misact. And I'm shocked by how far off I was, because a lot of the times in a moment when we make a decision, we can feel that confidence, and we can feel that arrogance, and we can go with it, and maybe we didn't have the best decision to be made, you know? I heard in my Saul Alinsky book when I was reading it, he says, talking about how you have to have the strength of will to be able to push your ideas when you know about it, but also able to put down our ideas when somebody else has a better one, you know, and being able to appreciate, accept, and promote somebody else's idea. You know, and that takes practice, and that's hard sometimes. And it's bitter to let go. It's bitter to disavow all of our great intentions. And behind intentions are expectations of what we think the world's going to respond to us as. But maybe that's inefficient. So I have lots of parenting examples. I have lots of examples in work, you know, of aggression, that is. Aggression has been laden throughout my life. And I learned it. Most likely, because prominent male figures that were in that role for me always showed aggression. First, you know, were important men, you know, and my most prominent being my father, and he's calmed down a lot over the years, and he's no longer as hot as he used to be. He's learned a lot about himself. I've learned a lot about me watching him learn about him. But there's others, and especially in men, I think aggression is taught and used, misused sometimes. I think it has its place. It's part of being human. It's in our natural tool sack of who it is to be us. And women show aggression too. I'm not going to make this a masculine-centric idea. You know, and women show aggression in different ways. But aggression is this tool that's used throughout society to implement change in some ways. And it is almost meant to show face. An example of how strong we are, how strong we think we are, and showing that on the outside, saying, hey, you know, I could do this, you can trust me. Or, you know, fuck off, you're not strong enough, you don't have any right to tell me anything. I guess there's that bend of it, you know, we should show aggression in order to turn somebody off too. But a lot of the times it can be used to turn people on, you know, and get people to think about ideas and not just shut them down. It's weird. And so I've had weird outlets of aggression off and on, always, you know. But in the recent couple moments, you know, the last couple months maybe, it's hard to put it's hard to put an envelope and try to sequester regions of our life, you know. And sometimes you can if you have like a holiday or like you go somewhere, you have like a nice little pocket of time that one week. But when I look back, I see a lot of Groundhog's Days, and it's hard for me to draw the line on where I want it to stop. But recently, I've definitely been burning some people in my head. Most important person in my life would be my son. And a lot of the times, I'm not sure how I end up in these situations of being so damn mad. And I'm not sure if what I'm doing is functional or right. But during the moment of that righteous anger, we feel vindicated. And so it's hard to see past that bullshit to see what we're actually doing. In that situation, when I look back on it, and how I feel when I look back on it, that humbles me. And it makes me feel small. And it makes me feel gross. And it makes me feel like I could do better. First of all, because I have a high rank for who I am. So last weekend, I had me and a friend sat down and took about two hits of LSD together. And LSD is a very powerful substance, and it is one of the ones that I don't prefer. I spent a lot of years not taking LSD, like almost 8 or 9 years where I refused to, because most of my uncomfortable trips and my uncomfortable experiences have been on LSD. I trust mushrooms a lot more, you know, and I've had some very uncomfortable experiences on DMT, like probably the worst ones have been on DMT, you know, but the longevity of LSD, because LSD lasts for so long. Like, and I'm very sensitive to the chemicals that hang around for a long time. And I'll take very, very small amounts of LSD, like a quarter hit or less in the morning, and then I'll go to work, and it'll get me stimulated, and it'll make me feel really involved in my work, but I'm not really quite catching the buzz, and I'd consider that a microdose of LSD. But even that will get me going for like 16 hours, and you know, I'll feel that little amount. I could sense it until I go to bed that night because of how long it hangs out. And so bigger dosages of LSD, which I've been doing LSD since I was probably 12 years old. It's one of the first substances that anybody ever exposed me to. And during high school, I take it like once or twice a week, you know, almost all of high school. And I have so many memories of coming into school just fried because I hadn't slept, you know, and remarkably getting very good grades. And, you know, I'd have really good notes from people because something about the serotonin experience has always been medicative for me, you know, and in a self-medicating way. That's why I keep frequency, because it keeps my brain in that mode of where I can appreciate things better. Anyways, so I took two hits of LSD, which is something I don't do often. I don't take more than a fraction, like once a year maybe. And I don't do it alone because that can be miserable. I'm not trying to be so pessimistic about it. I know a lot of people love it too. So I hate that I'm sounding so pessimistic about it right now. Some people really enjoy this stuff. I'm just very sensitive to stimulating experiences. I'm a very stimulated person. I don't have any issue keeping my energy levels up. And so when I add an additional upper, tends to make it hard to control this dumpster fire I'm sitting on all the time. But a lot of other people want that stimulation. A lot of people in our society, I feel, are understimulated, and that's why you have a lot of people drinking coffee, you know, all day long. And I will drink a cup of coffee at 6 o'clock in the morning. If I drink it after 11, I won't go to bed because it'll keep me going. It'll get me rabid. Rabid is a better word. You know, my energy is my detriment. You know, my energy ruins my work. You know, my energy burns people and gets people upset. Like, the way I do things when I work by myself, I can get going really fast, and it doesn't burn me as long as I slow down fast enough before I hit the wall, before I get home. You know, if I'm working with other people and I burn too fast and I get my energy level too high, it sets people into a tense state of mind, because we're all empathetic. We all pick up on each other. And so, and plus, I make mistakes when I'm going fast. So for me, when I'm at work, I'm trying to slow down. So I'm not chugging coffee at work. You know, the best thing for me at work is probably heroin. I'm not joking. That's why I got to stay away from this shit. But like, sedatives slow me down. That's why I like to be stoned. You know, that's why I get stoned for this. It's because it makes my words come out a lot slower. But I used to smoke at work. Like, all throughout high school and my early 20s, I was perpetually stoned at work, because it was the only way that I could get along with people, where I wasn't just burning them. Anyways, that's my little diatribe on stimulants. And I just want to put the caveat that I'm weird and that everybody's different. And everybody appreciates and approaches all these different substances differently. And no matter what the substance is, it's just bending you. So the part you're appreciating is still you, even if it's high. So keep in mind that you are what you are, even when the substance bends you. You know, you are more you. Substance, you're not becoming whatever it is you're putting in your body. Whatever you're putting in your body bends you, and you get to appreciate that different side of you you don't get to usually see. It doesn't make it any less real. It doesn't make it a delusion. It exists. You know, and you can learn something even from a bad high, I think. Which is what I've learned from LSD a lot. LSD makes me very insecure. It makes me very mindful of my actions and my rapidity. And when I'm with people, I talk a lot. And I end up getting excited, and I'll cut people off a lot. And a lot of people can get used to it and get used to being around me because they like listening to me. But I, inside, subconsciously feel bad every single time I cut somebody off. And I notice it like too late, when I'm like halfway through a story. So it's not even like I can be like, and I've tried it a couple times where I've been like, oh, I'm sorry, I cut you off. And then they're like, oh, I don't remember what I was saying. And I'm like, of course you don't. That's normal. But like, so me and my friend are sitting in this incredibly stimulated state of mind, and I'm high as hell and hallucinating like a lot. Shocked about how many things I saw bent and warpy for a very long stretch of time. And we're high like for like 10, 12 hours together. And the whole time, I'm just talking at this guy. I just talking. And he would bring up a personal story and probably a soft spot in his subconscious that he needed to speak out. And these were opportunities for me to shut up and let him talk, because I had a lot of soft spots in my brain, and I was just digging them all out, just pushing them out, vomiting them all out on this guy. And then, you know, I'd talk for like 45 minutes, and he'd bring up something for 5 minutes, and I would start lecturing and giving, like trying to tell him what to do with his life, and half realizing what I was doing, you know. But I was just belligerent almost, you know. So I was feeling so good and feeling so good about myself in a way that I thought I had any answers for this guy. And it was because I cared too, because I loved him and I wanted to help. But I could start to sense it throughout the night that he was shutting down, not wanting to speak as much, because I kept talking over him. And I started to feel sad. And right around, like, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, I knew deep inside my conscious that I wasn't going to be very happy with that evening. Several times I've had friends over and had intentions to give them the space that they needed, and then just talked over them the whole time, even when I was sober. And as soon as those friends would leave, I would get these crushing depressions from the realization of what I'd just done. And part of it was because I knew I was better, and because in pockets of my life and pockets of sensitivity, I've been able to quiet down and apply space, you know, the space for other people's emotions and for people to express themselves. Because 99% of the time, it's not anything that I can give a person that lets them heal. It's providing somebody the environment to feel comfortable enough to heal themselves. You see that? There's a big subtle difference between the two. Both members are trying to be helpful. But 6 o'clock in the morning comes, and you know, we've been high for a long time, and I get to trying to cook breakfast for my son because I bought some chorizo potatoes for him. And it's one of his favorite things. It's just like, you know, fry up some potatoes, bake them for, you know, 45 minutes to an hour, get them all crispy. Put in a little bit of chorizo and get the seasoning. I like the cheap shit just because they put a lot of seasoning in that. Probably cover up how shitty the meat is. The seasoning gets onto all the potatoes, and then you got some eggs. You crack some eggs in. And the trick is let the eggs hard cook all the way through. Don't mix them in. So you get all those whites and those yolks and big solid bits, and then you mix it all up, and then you have chorizo, eggs, and potatoes. You can put some more salt, chili pepper, oregano, onions maybe. If you put the onions in with the potatoes, or halfway through the potatoes, they're a really good dish. Anyways, I'm not cooking it very well because I'm high as hell, and my buddy's helping me. And I'm trying to clean this pan when I can barely see it, and it's a cast iron steel pan, and I'd cooked some pot sticker wontons on it the night before, and those fucking noodles like amalgamized into a concrete polymer on the bottom of that pan. I don't know if you've ever burnt mac and cheese, but that shit's miserable. And I'm trying to get this shit off when I can barely like hold my own hands, and I'm trying to strip it, and I'm fucking the pan up the whole time. And he starts saying, "You have any issues with sticking?" And I was like, "Oh, no, not really. I've been working on it for a couple of years." I think is what I said in my head, but I was like, "Oh, yeah, it sticks because it's a cast iron pan." That's what I said. Yeah, I was like, "Oh, yeah, it sticks. All cast iron sticks." He registered that as you could fix that. So he tries to give me advice on how to season the pan. And little old me, you know, because I was in this spot in my head, I was unable to take that little bit of advice because he was just trying to help me with my pan. And I could have listened and just been like, "Oh, really? What's your advice? Let me hear that." Sensitively, because he's not trying to hurt me or anything. But instead, I got defensive, which set him off. And I was like, "Oh, I know how to handle my pan." And he goes, "Oh, I'm sorry I gave you unsolicited advice." And that's when it hit me, like, really hard. I was like, "Damn. I've been giving this guy unsolicited advice for the last 10 hours. And he could take it all night long without being a bastard. And the first time anybody tries to give me anything, I just completely turned into a rabid animal." And it made me really sad. And that's when I realized the full extent of how my arrogance had flown throughout the evening. And that humbled me immensely. You know, ever since that night, I've been trying really hard not to give anybody unsolicited advice. I've been trying really hard to only listen and just trying to be quiet a lot more. Being quiet has been like the pinnacle of all of my attention for years now, it seems, is learning quietness and learning how to talk less. Allowing others to just be, you know, and that's humbling to see that from the outside, really. And I think part of the experience that made it so difficult, too, was that I had to live it. I had to do it. And I had to be the bastard. And I had to be the thing that I'm not really proud of. And I didn't like. And that's what taught me, is showing, like, that part of me, you know, this participle of me, this facet of me, this bend of the rainbow that I can shine as. I can be this. This is part of who I am sometimes. You know, that taught me humbly how I really want to treat people, which is a lot more allowance. And so that 10 hours of uncomfortability, you know, because I'd get high on my words. I'd feel good when I was talking. And then as soon as I'd stop talking, it's like this crash of hormones, feeling. You know, and then as soon as my friend left, it was just like, vroom. I was just in this pit of darkness for a while. But I had to live it. I had to be the character. I had to go through the role. And now I'm in a I want to treat people better, and I have been a lot better about talking, not talking. I mean, but like, it's hard from the outside. Like, I was talking with my therapist about a lot of this situation, and she always tells me that I'm too hard on myself. I'm always too critical, and I know that's part of this too, is being too critical. But I trust in my gut that that's the right direction, is quietness. And she asked me, what could you have been trying to do? And I told her, well, it feels good when you control somebody, you know, even subconsciously, when you give somebody an order in like a leadership position at work, even if you don't realize it, it feels good to have somebody do what you want them to do. You know, it feels good to have help, maybe, to say that a different way. It doesn't sound as bad. It feels good to be helped. But I don't think that's the best way to do things with people. You could teach a man to fish, or you can give him a fish. And I think teaching him the act of supporting himself is the act of the environmental space, and that comes from quietness. You could talk at a person till the cows come home, but you can never give somebody experience. You can never give somebody your experience, your sensitivity, and your feelings about something. But you can use your experience and your feelings about something to have compassion for somebody and to allow them the space to evolve into that. And that takes faith too, maybe, is to have the faith that somebody will find it on their own. And maybe some people don't. There's this huge spectrum of what it means to be a human. Like, I've been getting frustrated with how people experience psychedelia. And I've had this influx of people who have trouble getting off. And you might be one of those people, you know. And I think that penultimately has nothing to do with the drug or the substance when it comes to people getting shut out. Because the shutout is what it's often called in DMT. DMT was one of the first times I heard about it the most. As soon as I started smoking DMT 10 years ago. And as soon as I started talking to other people who do, you know, and as soon as I started smoking it a lot, you know, like probably the first 10 times, and then my 11th was probably a shutout. And to describe what this is, you know, DMT is a very powerful substance. So it's like you have like a really big hammer, and you think it's going to smash the rock every time. Horrible metaphor. Like, usually the first time you approach it, it's splendid. And the way that it acts, it's exhilarating. And so it seems impossible that you could smoke it and for something not very much to happen. And like, I've been shut out and immediately smoked it and been able to blast again. So it's like, it's not like it's like a setting thing. And it probably is. But like, it's not like the brain, like I've had some people say like, maybe your serotonin's burned out. And I don't believe that. I really don't. I think it is more about the sensitivity in the moment and not exactly about the environment, but the perceiver. Now the perceiver has positioned themselves. And maybe sometimes it's just how the stars are aligned. One of the first times I was shut out though, it's like a heartbreaking experience. And at this point, I had fallen so in love with the experience itself that I wanted it so bad that it felt like being denied, like having somebody shut a door in your face. It's kind of like the feeling. And for several years, I would take it personal, which I don't anymore. Like, if you ever do get shut out and something is just very banal and you don't get to trip like you wanted to, let it go. That's the lesson, is go along with your day. Don't take it personally. It's a great exercise in learning humility in the face of expectation. Because it's showing you that you can't make anything happen. You can't perform a spell. It's not Lingardian Leviosa. You can't just make it do its thing. You can't just kick your brain. It's like you have your brain on the sidewalk and you're poking it with a stick like a jellyfish. Like, do something cool. Like, you have to respect yourself too, you know? So I see it as a practice. It's a faith and trusting. And when you have faith and trust in your subconscious, I personally believe, especially with DMT, with faith, the shutouts happen less and less. Knock on wood. But like, I haven't been shut out in a minute. And it got to the point several years back when I was smoking it so frequently that I'd get shut out probably 1 in 3, and I'd smoke it 2 or 3 times a day. So I was getting shut out every day, and then having this like pseudo traumatic experience where I'd be like, well, what's wrong with me? I'm Eeyore. And I'd go walk around for like fucking an hour and be sad as shit, you know, just because I couldn't see some pretty things. And part of it was because that's all I wanted, was just to have a light show, and I wasn't needing help, you know. And that's why over the, especially the last 2 years, my practice with DMT has cut back significantly. You know, I don't think about when I'm going to do it. I don't plan doses. You know, still probably 80% of the times that I smoke DMT is when I'm in a frustrated state of mind. It's when I need help. And, you know, I'll sit with myself for a little bit and I'll ask myself for help. And I'll also be like, please don't hurt me. And for a while, I direct that towards the drug, but that's not true. The substance isn't hurting me. I'm the only person who hurts me when it comes to these things. And I could put myself in weird corners when certain chemicals are there. You know, and even with things like LSD, I'm sure I could practice my own energy levels. Maybe in several years, decades, maybe I'll have the self-control to not have an evening like that, even when I'm being bent to a certain extreme. Maybe I'll have the self-control through my own self-respect to give people space. See? But yet again, I'm not blaming the LSD, even though the pessimistic way that I described it for several minutes shows how I still kind of am. But I shouldn't. You know, the most important thing at the end of these experiences is how we see the prism that bends, you know, the light, because that's us, really. And then the light show goes through the prism and we see everything painted like a hologram on reality. All right. I've significantly lost myself, and probably many of you. I hope you enjoyed my little ramble about aggression and uses of humility with confidence and its counter, the arrogance, how we treat each other in our interactions and how we can apply space or we can apply force, how we have many moments throughout our day that can humble us with our own psyche, under the influence or not, and when we're with others and how we treat them and how we can analyze the situation afterwards, or how we feel about it, not even analyzing it, how we can feel about it afterwards too. So I think you're all lovely people. I'm gonna go find a book and I'll read a little bit before we go get over it. All right. I'm starting with Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. I'm a little bit further into the book and I'm a little bit more comfortable with sharing what I think is his root ideas. So this is from his chapter on communication, which I think is funny. He's talking about how people are impacted differently by how close a situation is to them. Here it goes. Communication on a general basis without being fractured into the specifics of experience becomes rhetoric. And it carries a very limited meaning. It is the difference between being informed of the death of 250,000 people, which becomes a statistic, or the death of one or two close friends or loved ones or the member of one's family. In the latter, it becomes the full emotional impact of the finality of tragedy. In trying to explain what the personal relationship means, I have told various audiences. If the chairman of this meeting had opened up by saying, I am shocked and sorry to have to report to you that we have just been notified that Mr. Alinsky has been killed in a plane crash and therefore this lecture is canceled, the only reaction you would have would be, well, gee, that's too bad. I wonder what he was like. But oh well, let's see. What are we going to do this evening? We've got the evening free now. Let's go to a movie. And that is all that one would expect, except of those who have known me in the past, regardless of what the relationship was. Now suppose after finishing this lecture, let us assume that all of you have disagreed with everything I have said. You don't like my face, the sound of my voice, my manner, my clothes. You just don't like me, period. Let us further assume that I am to lecture to you again next week, and at that time you are informed of my sudden death. Your reaction will be very different, regardless of your dislike. You will react with shock. You will say, why, just yesterday he was alive, breathing, talking, and laughing. It just seems incredible to believe that suddenly like that, he's gone. This is the human reaction to a personal relationship. What is of particular importance here, however, is the fact that you are not dealing with one specific person, but a general mass. All right. So he's pretty good. I hope you enjoy. One last little bit. Let's see if I can find a good one by Mr. Watts. Ba-doop. Ba-doop. All right. This is from the book. It's kind of like a look at Hindu principles such as the idea of the self. Like basically this whole book is him trying to explain what the self is, the big self, not personality, you know, the thing behind it all, which can have a lot of other names as well. And here we go. A still more cogent example of existence as relationship is the production of a rainbow. For a rainbow appears only when there is a certain triangular relationship between three components: the sun, moisture in the atmosphere, and an observer. If all three are present, and if the angular relationship between them is correct, then and then only will there be the phenomena rainbow. Diaphanous as it may be, a rainbow is no subjective hallucination. It can be verified by any number of observers, though each will see it in a slightly different position. As a boy, I once chased the end of a rainbow on my bicycle and was amazed to find that it always receded. It was like trying to catch the reflection of the moon on water. I did not then understand that no rainbow would appear unless the sun, and I, and the invisible center of the bow were on the same straight line, so that I changed the apparent position of the bow as I moved. The point is, then, that an observer in the proper position is as necessary for the manifestation of a rainbow as the other two components, the sun and the moisture. Of course, one can say that if the sun and the body of moisture were in the right relationship, say, over the ocean, any observer on a ship that sailed into the line would then see a rainbow. But one could also say that if an observer and the sun were correctly aligned, there would be a rainbow if there was moisture in the air. Somehow, the first set of conditions seems to preserve the reality as the reality of the rainbow apart from an observer. Sorry. But the second set, by eliminating a good solid external reality, seems to make it an indisputable fact that under such conditions, there is no rainbow. The reason is only that it supports our current mythology to assert that things exist on their own, whether there is an observer or not. It supports the fantasy that man is not really involved in the world, that he makes no real difference to it, and that he can observe reality independently without changing it. For the myth of this solid and sensible physical world, which is there, whether we see it or not, it goes hand in hand with the myth that every observer is a separate ego confronted with a reality quite other than himself, depending on his vantage point. All right. Watts is deep, but I hope you got some of the things that I got out of it. It means that the moisture in the air and the sun and the person, the phenomena, even if we're not there, the observer makes it appear into reality. You know, the conditions, the sun and the moisture, are always present. So in a way, the rainbow's there, but the rainbow's not, because it's not presently being observed. So how much part of life is an observation? How much part do we play in observing? These kind of things excite me, make me feel like there's this bottomless sense of wonder in approaching this beautiful world. And it makes me grateful to have a place in it and to be able to have all these opportunities to catch different observations. And it makes me very grateful to know that you're here with me. And I think you're a lovely being. I hope you have a great day. Let's go see how Odin is getting along.
Hello, people. It's Ask Odin here. So I'm just telling you stuff.
I like stuff.
I'm just telling you this. There's a new thing on Netflix. I'm gonna tell you later that I'm gonna tell you what it's actually important. So, it's the weekend and stuff. Yeah, my dad's thinking to go to Sky Summer or the place or a
yeah, a lot to do today.
Arcade, maybe. We might do it, and I'm gonna tell you about the thing. It's on Netflix.
Netflix.
It's only on Netflix.
What is it?
So there's this thing called Dance Monsters, where there's monsters, and dance and make music. So, keep watching it, and then you can hear great songs.
Oh, that's a really good, endorsement from a very smart little boy.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for your time, Mom.
Yeah.
Appreciate you.
Yeah.
Love you.
Love you.
Bye, guys.
Bye.